This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
When Francisco Cantu graduated from college with a degree in international relations, he did something that surprised his mother. He decided to join the Border Patrol. He told his mother that it would give him a perspective on border issues that was missing from his classroom. She was skeptical. She told him, "You make it sound like you'll be communing with nature and having heartfelt conversations all day." Those heartfelt conversations, no surprise, never happened. But Cantu wrote a book reflecting on the 4 years he spent on the Border Patrol in the deserts of Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. It's called, and it's a lovely title, "The Line Becomes a River." And although Cantu clearly takes a liberal view, one that's critical of border policy, there are some on the left who have attacked him in the book as too complicit somehow with the policies that he was carrying out. Francisco Cantu spoke with staff writer Sarah Stillman, who's covered immigration and the border for The New Yorker.
So really early in the book, you have this difficult conversation with your mother about your decision to join Border Patrol. And she points out that you've just graduated with a college degree in international relations, and she kind of implies the job is beneath you. And you say that you're sick of reading about the border in books and you want to be on the ground. So I'm wondering if you can just tell us a little bit more about why you joined the Border Patrol.
I think my mom would be really terrified to hear this. Well, she knows this now. I think she would have been terrified to hear it at the time. But because she was a park ranger while I was growing up, and because we lived in the Southwest and I had grown up close to the desert, I think that's kind of one of the essential components of what I felt was missing from being at university and college and doing all this book learning about the border and about immigration. You know, I went to school in D.C., so very far from the border itself. And all of that learning felt disconnected from, you know, the realities of the landscape and the people and the culture that I knew growing up. And so that was part of it. And, of course, another part of it was that sort of idealism that you have as a 23-year-old when, you know, you're just coming out of college. And I think I was also idealistic, thinking that I would be able to sort of, you know, enter this large system, as a lot of young people do, I think, enter this large institution and sort of remain intact with my morals and my ethics and, like, move through it and just, you know, collect observations and answers. And I thought that I would really see things that would help me unlock these questions about the border, about immigration. I thought I would, you know, then I told myself I'd be able to become an amazing policymaker or some great immigration lawyer.
Do you look back on that as naive? Or I remember your mother says in the book, you know, the Border Patrol is not the Park Service. It is a paramilitary police force.
I do look back on that as being naive. I think, especially when you're a young person, you have so much confidence in yourself and who you are. And when you join an institution, you begin to lend all of these parts of yourself and your identity and, you know, your soul in order to, you know, help the institution accomplish its goals, further the institutional goals. And that happens in subtle ways, slowly. And so I think, you know, by the time I was out in the field doing the job, I had already put aside a lot of those questions just in order to be able to do the work. And I think, you know, that really terrified somebody like my mom, who was the one person, you know, holding me accountable, vigilantly watching, you know, to see if I was losing track of myself and who I was and the person that I had been outside of that job.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the work. I mean, you really go into the nitty-gritty of, you know, the daily field work of being a Border Patrol agent. And I'm wondering if you can tell us just what you actually did, what you encountered on a typical day in the field. What was the work like at a granular level?
You know, I think when I first entered the job, there were a lot of things that I was very drawn to. First and foremost, being outside. I mean, I love the desert. And I've never been closer to a landscape than the area that I worked, where I got my field training and where I worked for those first 2 years as an agent. And of course, you do all of this disconnecting between what you're learning and what it is that you're learning it for. You know, to me, it was to learn how to track and to learn how to, you know, cut for sign, as we call it, to learn every pass in a given range of mountains, to know every mile marker of a stretch of highway. You know, that was, in a way, exhilarating. But of course, looking back on it, you're learning to understand a landscape in order to capture people. And of course, that's not what you're thinking at the time. At the time, you're thinking, wow, I'm learning so much. And then, you know, there's the regular stuff that you would expect, you know, like car chases, drug busts. And I think that can be really distracting. But when I left the Border Patrol and I look back on it, what really sticks out to me are those human moments, those interactions, you know, all that other, you know, stuff that might seem exciting faded away. And what I was left with, you know, was trying to grapple with all these people that I had apprehended and interacted with. And then, you know, they had been risking their lives to cross the desert. And at the end of the day, I was taking them back to a cell and sending them back to the places that they were risking their lives to flee.
Yeah, right. On that note, you actually write about destroying the supplies of migrants at one point, that water gets destroyed, blankets, food, the stuff that's left along the crossing routes. Why does Border Patrol do this? And why did, if I understand correctly, you do this?
You know, when I was being trained, I actually never witnessed this happen, and I never partook in that. But, you know, I had it kind of like explained very casually by you know, by like the training agents, you know, like, oh, you get rid of all of their supplies, and then it just makes it makes it easier because then they'll quit and they'll come out to the road. It's easier to catch them, you know, and that's just that's such a short-sighted, deadly thinking. And so for me, you know, having seen a dead body in the desert, when I think about that man, he died from dehydration in August, in, you know, the hottest part of the summer. And if he had found a water bottle, if he had had access to that aid, like, he would have lived, because people are lost and disoriented, and people lose their lives that way.
So there's not a ton of politics in the book. And, of course, in the age of Trump, where the border is so heavily politicized, it was striking for me to realize how much, at least in the beginning of the book, you really process being an agent as a physical challenge, a challenge of the landscape in some ways. And of course, we hear the president and his rhetoric around what a wall would do for us. But having seen it on the ground, what's your sense of that?
In the station where I worked, we had several miles of 20-foot-high steel mesh fencing. And my experience with the wall is that smugglers had figured out a way to pry open these steel panels and, using hydraulic jacks, you know, lift them high enough that they could drive vehicles underneath. And for just a group of people, they would weld an opening big enough for people to crawl through. And so I don't think that that's an argument for a bigger, stronger, more impenetrable barrier. I think that that shows us that no matter what obstacle we put at the border, it's going to be subverted. You know, people will find a way up, over, under, around it. And, you know, what we also know is that, you know, if we keep building more walls, if we hire more Border Patrol agents, we've done both of those things. We know that the same consequences will happen. You know, last year, how many times did you hear that crossings were down, right? I think crossings were at their lowest point in 14 years for a while. And you heard that over and over again. But what we haven't heard is that the border deaths along the desert actually went up. So, you know, for me, when I think about that fact, it's not abstract to me. What I think about is the man whose body I encountered in the desert. And, you know, I remember what he looked like, and I remember these details, like, you know, the ants crawling across his body, or like the foam that collected at the edges of his mouth. And what I think about even more than that man are the two boys who were with him. He was with his 19-year-old nephew and the nephew's friend. They're all from the same village. They made the crossing together. They got lost and left behind. And I was the person, because I spoke the best Spanish of the people who were there, who had to explain to these boys who wanted to stay with his body, who wanted to bring his body back to the village where they came from. Because in Mexico and in so many other places in Latin America or Central America, if you don't have the body, you have nothing. You don't know what happened to that person. And so I had to explain to them why they had to leave the body. And all I had were these bureaucratic, you know, okay, the county medical examiner is going to come and determine the cause of death, and then the body will be turned over to the Mexican consulate, and you'll contact the Mexican consulate. Maybe the Mexican consulate will give you some paperwork that you can bring to your family. Then you'll rearrange with them for the repatriation of the body. And, you know, I remember that those boys just nodded because they saw a man in uniform telling them things, and they knew that they had to nod.
It seems to have also taken a physical and psychological toll on you. At one point in the book, you visit your dentist. You find out you had started to grind your teeth. And your dentist actually looks in your mouth and says, quote, "It's getting kind of ugly in there." So did you understand in real time what was happening to you, and what was your body telling you?
That moment in the dentist's office was an interesting moment for me, because I think Border Patrol, much like any law enforcement, is sort of, the culture is such that you don't really talk about your work, or you don't really talk about the ways that you might be internalizing violence, right? And even if you had asked me during that time, you know, "How are you?" I would have been, "Fine." Like, "How's your job?" "Oh, it's fine." But that moment, I had all these dreams where my teeth were crumbling out, or where I was clenching my jaws and couldn't stop clenching them, to the point to where, like, my teeth would explode inside of my mouth. And so when I went to the dentist after having those dreams for years, and he said, "You know, you've ground through several layers of the enamel on your teeth," I was like, that was the first time I had a real world manifestation of that sort of, like, subconscious creeping horror. And I think a lot of people ask me about that in interviews, and it almost makes me uncomfortable to, like, talk about having bad dreams, because, you know, I was, that entire time I was in a position of power and privilege over people. And I think that grappling with power and our relationship to it, and what do we do once we, you know, realize the ways that we've wielded power, I think that's another really important part of the conversation that we're having right now.
How have your former Border Patrol colleagues interpreted the book if they've read it?
So I've shared the book primarily with former colleagues that are somehow represented in the book or people in the Border Patrol that I was close to. So kind of just a handful of agents. And the response from a lot of them has been sort of, oh, I didn't realize you were having such a hard time. I didn't realize that the work was hard for you. One of my coworkers called me just last week because he had finished reading the book, and he said, hey, man, I want to apologize. Like, I'm so sorry. I could kind of tell that something was amiss, and I never asked you about it. And I said, you know, don't apologize. Like, it's not the culture of the Border Patrol, just like it's not the culture of the military or law enforcement or any of these sort of hyper-masculine worlds to talk about how sort of violence and might be affecting you, like the violence that you partake in, how you might be internalizing that.
You wrote that your parents initially planned to name you Joshua Tyler Cantu Simmons instead of Francisco Cantu. And you also write that if that name had stuck, you would be a different person. And so I thought that was a very salient point in a book that's partly about the arbitrary nature of the lines that we draw. So I'm just wondering how you would be different if you were Joshua Simmons. Would you have written this book? Could this book exist?
My mom talks a lot about that. And you know, what she says is that, you know, at the hospital, they made her put a name on the birth certificate before leaving with me, and they hadn't really decided. And she was with my dad, who she very soon after I was born separated from, and they had talked about this name, Joshua and Tyler. And then, like, as soon as I got home, you know, my mom started calling me this other name. And, you know, by the time I was becoming adult, like, that name, you know, like, that's what drew me to speak Spanish. I mean, I was like, I can't go through the world as Francisco Cantu not speaking Spanish. But
oh,
I didn't,
so
grow,
didn't grow up
speaking Spanish.
Okay.
My mother didn't grow up speaking Spanish. And so, I mean, I think it just kind of goes to show you the power of a name. You know, a name is a reminder of where you're from. And it's also sort of a reminder of, like, your parents' hope for you in the world.
Francisco Cantu was a Border Patrol agent from 2008 to 2012. His new book is The Line Becomes a River, and he spoke with Sarah Stillman, a staff writer for The New Yorker.